You really don't want me to play, huh?
No, I do. Captain Howdy said no.
Captain who?
Captain Howdy.
Who's Captain Howdy?
You know, I make the questions and he does the answers.
Oh.
Captain Howdy, yeah, I see.
He's nice.
Oh, I bet he is.
Hello and welcome. Welcome and hello. This is Wait, You Haven't Seen. It's a show where we talk about movies, and specifically, we talk about a movie at least one of us never seen before. I'm your host, Travis, aka TV's Travis. This is episode number 260, and our movie this week is 1973's The Exorcist. And here to talk with me about it, because he had not seen it before, it's the senior geek, Gary. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing great. How you been?
Very, very good. Busy, yeah. Busy. It is coming up on, I'm going to a conference here soon for Warhammer, and so I have been furiously painting miniatures for hours on end for the last few days because I procrastinate with the best of them.
Well, I'm recently retired, so I now have time to watch movies that I never got to before. So,
well, there you go.
So I watched this 2-hour long movie that should have been 90 minutes at least, at most. But anyway...
So the question first is, how is it you hadn't seen that? You're obviously familiar with it. It's kind of impossible to escape The Exorcist in at least a passing knowledge of that. But how is it you never saw it? Are you much of a horror movie fan at all?
I'm not really much of a horror movie fan. Okay. I think you put up a list of movies the other day, you know, asking who had seen what. And I haven't seen, what's the found footage one? Blair Witch. I haven't seen that. I have no interest in it. And so I wasn't interested in it when it first came out. And as time went by, there was other things. And I do remember at one point there was something that I thought was The Exorcist on HBO, and I didn't have anything to do one afternoon, and I put it on. And after I finished reading or watching it, whatever I did to it, it turned out to be one of the many, many, many remakes, sequels, whatever.
Got it.
So I hadn't actually seen the original one.
All right. And, you know, normally I don't get somebody who was around when a movie came out, depending on how old it is, but you were actually, I mean, you would have been how old when this came out?
I would have turned 24 that summer.
Okay. So, and you just had no interest in the movie at all, but were you familiar at all with kind of the hype around it and maybe some of the hysteria?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was back, you know, when everybody was getting super excited about everything. I mean, got into the 80s and you had, you know, Satanic Fever and all that.
Right.
So, you know, it didn't really surprise me at that point. I was pretty much still a hippie, so.
Okay. Yeah. So that makes sense. I'm not really into the horror scene.
Yeah.
I buy that.
I wasn't going to a whole lot of movies then either, so.
So, okay. So you watch this for the first time, and I have a feeling based on your comment, kind of how you felt about it, but your comment of a 2-hour movie that should have been an hour and a half. So what did you think overall, just sitting down and watching The Exorcist, based on sort of, you know, what you had heard about it? And I mean, how did it seem to you watching this now?
One of the surprises for me was the makeup job on Max von Sydow,
right?
For 1973, because he's always been one of my favorite actors. And the fact that I didn't even recognize him in the first part of the movie in Iraq or wherever it was, mm-hmm. And I got halfway through the movie and I said, wait a minute, isn't Max von Sydow in here? And you know, I looked it up and I actually found a before and after picture because he was only 44 at the time.
Right.
And he definitely looked to be in his 70s. So that was a pretty good makeup job. But I don't know. Maybe it's the internet age. The very, very, very slow development of the plot. I know they're building suspense and all of that, mm-hmm. but I didn't think it. I mean, I've watched old episodes of Rockford Files, and you know they'll have like a 5-minute scene of somebody driving down the street, and you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, for sure. Oh yeah. On the subject of the makeup job for Max von Sydow, that was one of my notes, and that's one of the things I always take away from this was he convincingly looks like he's in his 70s there. And
right.
For me, it's funny because I've seen him in so many things and I love him in so much, but I always think of him as being 60, 70 years old because I think of this movie and then I think of the more recent stuff that I've seen him in cameo he had in Star Wars. Yep. Yeah. You know, stuff like Minority Report, even like where he was finally in his 60s and up. Because this makeup job was just so convincing. And then you realize, oh no, he was like 44 when this came out. He was, you know, still fairly young man. So yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Oh,
Ellen Burkin, I was having thought, you know, Ellen Burkin, I think was born looking 40 years old. And then I looked it up and she was 40 years old when this was, was filmed. So, that wasn't surprising. But the only,
yeah.
Other thing I've seen her in was Same Time Next Year with Alan Alda.
Oh, right.
That I can recall, but yeah.
And she's fantastic in this. Ellen Burstyn is really convincing to me. Everybody I think in this cast really nailed it and was convincing in what they were going through.
Right.
Nobody. And we'll talk kind of what they did for Reagan. In a little bit, just kind of the combination of actors and things that went on to make that performance. Mm-hmm. But Ellen Burstyn, Jason Miller as Father Karras.
Right.
He had been acting on stage prior to this, but this was his first film. This was his first credit in any kind of film or television was this movie. And he was nominated for an Academy Award. Right. For his performance. And
I don't think he did a whole lot after that. He looked kind of familiar to me, but
he did a little bit, but a lot of his career, he did a lot of stage work. He preferred stage work. And so he did more of that. He was in a few movies, including actually returning as Father Karras in The Exorcist 3.
Which was hard to do because he was dead.
Yeah, it's a confusing way that it happened with a different possession.
Yeah.
But he's also, the father of Jason Patrick.
Not sure who Jason Patrick is, but,
he did quite a bit in the, he was around in the 80s. I think he was in Lost Boys, if I remember right, but he was in the 80s and kind of 90s. He's been acting for a while. But Jason Miller, his father, he also is a, Pulitzer Prize winning, playwright. He won, for a play he wrote the year before he was in The Exorcist. So he did a lot of stage work, but he's just great in this because he's kind of really outside of the mom, Chris and Reagan, he's the main character. He's there's kind of two stories going on at once. Mm-hmm. There's everything going on with Reagan and then there's Father Karras and sort of his
feeling guilty that, I wasn't clear what happened. Did he pull his mother out of the hospital and put her back in her home and then she died there or did she die in the hospital? It was not clear to me.
Yeah, it's a little muddy exactly. Yeah. But yeah, he's dealing with that guilt and sort of this crisis of faith he's going through and his position as both a priest but also a psychologist. Has him dealing with a lot of different people, which I'm sure makes it even harder for him. And then, you know, you throw in the stuff that's going on with his mom, his mom was played by a Greek actor who had never been in a movie before either. So a lot of kind of first timers in this. We mentioned Max von Sydow. Lee J. Cobb plays Lieutenant Kinderman.
Yeah, I had to stop and say, he looks familiar. Who the heck is he? And then, Lee J. Cobb, of course. Yes.
One of his last movies, actually, he passed away a couple years after this came out. And so this is based on a book, and in the book, his character's got a little bit more to do. But he's really good in this too, because again, it's the believability, right? Like he's the cop that sort of, there's something going on, but he doesn't really understand what, and he's trying to figure it out, but he never comes right out to ask his questions. I kind of like that about Kinderman. He's always like dancing around stuff with people and trying to like feel them out.
Doing the, I'm having a senior moment. The guy that as he's walking down, I went, oh, just one more question.
Yeah. Columbo.
Columbo. That's yeah. So, yeah, I was having a hard time telling if he just wasn't a very good cop or, you know, just a nice guy or if he, you know, so, I mean, there are a bunch of things about this movie that were, I just wasn't sure what was going on and what it was supposed to symbolize. And, I'm on the spectrum. And if you don't spell something out for me a lot of times, it's like, okay.
And a lot of that is there's intentional vagaries in this. So as I mentioned, this was based on a book. William Peter Blatty wrote the book, The Exorcist, and I think it was published in 71 or 72.
Okay.
And then so it got optioned
at that time. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was wildly popular, got optioned to make a movie, and he wrote the screenplay. So the author of the novel wrote the screenplay. And then he worked with William Friedkin was the director of this. Friedkin had just done The French Connection, prior to this, yeah,
which I did see when it came out. So,
well, there you go. And so there were some changes made from the book to the screen version, most of which was kind of Bill Friedkin playing up more. So the book is a little bit more ambiguous of, is she actually possessed or is it more psychosomatic? And sort of the questions around that, because there is a thing in the book where Reagan has a book on witchcraft that they find. Mm. And, there's a lot more that dives into sort of the psychology of it and like her dealing with her parents' divorce and kind of all of that stuff. And it's still very much a possession story, but it's a little bit more ambiguous about it. And Friedkin thought, well, we got to play more into the visuals of this. And so he wanted to go that route. So they butted heads a little bit, and there were some things that ended up getting cut that did get later put back in or alluded to, most of which was, there's the conversation at the end with Lieutenant Kinderman and the other priest, Father Dyer, who kind of shows up early on and then he comes back at the end. He's the one that goes up to Father Karras. He actually played by an actual priest, William O'Malley. He was the technical director, and then they cast him to be Father Dyer. So there was a conversation with those two about the movies that I think was originally cut from the theatrical version.
Mm-hmm.
And basically a lot of the stuff that got cut with some of the character work, and later on Friedkin and Blatty came together and he added back in a couple of things. There's also the version you watched had the when she walks down the staircase, spider walks down.
No, it was
no.
Missing
okay.
I think I watched it on Prime.
Okay.
I rented it on Amazon Prime. So whatever version they have there.
So that was a thing that got cut out that they put back in like 1999. This movie got a re-release. I think it was 99. But yeah, it was just little things like that. So they butted heads a little bit, but I kind of like the idea of, because obviously every time you take a story and you put it to a new medium, you do have to adapt it. And so I think in a book form, the more ambiguous nature of everything works a lot better on the written page as you're reading it, because you're developing all of the imagery in your head. But when it comes to a film, show us stuff. And so they added in.
Well, in Ready Player One, the task that he had to perform wouldn't have filmed very easily.
Right.
And so they gave a different, more, you know, film friendly task to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say, I can't remember what either one of them was, but similar idea though. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there were things added in, like the levitation isn't in the book.
Right.
A lot of the furniture moving around.
Well, if they were leaving it ambiguous as to whether or not she was having a psychological breakdown or was actually possessed, you know, you couldn't have any physical manifestations like that.
Right. Yeah.
So, Or they'd have to be very subtle.
Yeah. So like they had in the book, when stuff would get moved around, like the furniture, it would all happen mm-hmm. when Reagan was alone. Like the right. door would be closed and they'd open it up and stuff would be moved. And that way there's the doubt of, did she move it or did it move on its own? Whereas in the movie, we obviously see the dresser move on its own or the drawer open up or her levitation. So, but I did like how in the movie, it's still, I like the slow burn nature of it, but I understand. And it's the biggest criticism that I hear when people watch it for the first time, or I talk to somebody who maybe didn't see it until later on, is it just moves so slow and it's 2 hours long. And I get that completely.
Well, and I think it's just because entertainment nowadays is a lot faster paced. Mm-hmm. So you don't have, as I say, a 90 second long, scene of somebody pondering while they're walking down the sidewalk to set a mood. You know, you're just like bam, 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 bam these days. Cause mm-hmm. I think we're losing our attention span.
Oh, for sure. Now I love slow burns. It's kind of why I like Kubrick. And also guys like David Lynch do a lot of that stuff where they let a scene or a shot sort of linger and marinate a little bit. And Friedkin would do that here. And I think too, it's a very slow moving story, right? Because it's a 2 hour movie and we spend an hour and 20 minutes of that where she's not really ever actually possessed per se. And it's a lot of questioning of it and sort of setting that up. So for me, I like the slow burn of it because I think what it does is it sets up caring about Reagan and about her mom and their relationship. And we spend enough time with them that when things really go south, it matters. But I would say that to your question, when the possession took place, it starts kind of at the beginning of the movie. By the time, it's a slow process. So right. in demonology, which when I was younger, I did a lot of paranormal stuff. I was really into it. I listened to a lot of things like that. And one of the things I talk about in that is the stages of possession are mm-hmm. going through depression first and mood changes. And it's a slow thing that wears down over time till you get to full blown possession. And so that was one of the things I think the movie does show off pretty well, because you've got Reagan who, beginning of the movie, she seems like a normal kid. She's fine, but she's already mm-hmm. been messing with the Ouija board and talking about Captain Howdy and all of that.
Yeah.
And by the time she's at the doctor, there's subtle things they did. I captured some audio we'll play later that is one of those things where like they did a little thing with her voice, or they start talking about different behavior. And what you get is it compounds and it ramps up over time until finally it just hits the top point and she looks like Linda Blair in this movie and spitting pea soup and all that kind of stuff. So I love that. I like that slow burn, but fully understand that part of it is you're just like, come on, get to it. Let's go. I'm an hour and a half into my 2 hour movie and I haven't, right. You're going to have an exorcism in your exorcism movie type of thing.
And was the possession, was the medallion, was that how the possession was transferred? And in that case, you know, where was this demon in all the time between the time the guy was in Iraq and or Iran, wherever the heck he was supposed to be, and when they got to Washington, D.C.?
So, yeah, they never give you that info, right? It just sort of happened. It just happened to be her. And this movie did, I think, really feed into what became the satanic panic in the 80s, and especially around Ouija boards.
Right.
Which were, you know, they're just a toy. But this movie, I think, fed a lot of the, because I know when I was growing up, man, I better not have touched one of those boards, because my mom was not a fan of those, and I'm pretty sure a lot of that is from this movie.
I played Dungeons and Dragons in my 30s in the 1980s, and I had devout Christian friends that were fearing for my soul. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is very vague on, like, how did that happen? Because the beginning of it, which is a rock that he's in, and it was actually funny. Friedkin had to get a whole British film crew to go film those scenes because at the time the U.S. had no relations to get in there, so he couldn't bring a U.S. film crew over. That basically just gives us Father Merrin and where he came from, but we don't know anything about what happened between then and how the demon, which is never named in the movie, but is named later, I think in one of the sequels, it's Pazuzu is the name of the demon.
I listened to the Film Sack episode on this.
Yes.
And, they named the demon Pazuzu, and I wondered how they knew that, but.
It's interesting that we don't get that. It just sort of happened to this girl in Georgetown randomly. They bring in Father Merrin, and they bring in and Father Karras. And I like that too, because this sort of set up the trope of the, you know, I need a young priest and an old priest, which I always think of. And then I realize, oh, it's just because Father Merrin was the only person that had done an exorcism. And Father Karras was the one that knew the family or knew enough to be there and wanted to be part of it. It's interesting to me. I did read, and this is kind of cool, this was the first horror movie nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture.
Yeah, that's what I heard too. So.
It did not win.
Don't think it won.
No, I don't remember what won that year. But it did. I mean, it had. Oh, it won two Oscars. Oh, it won an Oscar. So William Peter Blatty won for Best Adapted Screenplay, which got to kind of love that. The screenplay author wins the Best Adapted Screenplay for adapting his own novel. But I guess the best person to adapt it is the one that wrote it. So, it also won for Best Sound.
Godfather in 73.
Oh, well. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway,
that's I get that. I can see how that won over The Exorcist. Although it's pretty impressive to be nominated for Best Picture for, you know, what is, it is a horror movie. Best Sound was the other thing it won. So adapted screenplay and sound.
Well, one of the other things that, and I had to, you know, cast my mind back to like, the early 70s, but the amount of smoking that went on in this picture.
Yeah.
It was like, I live in Southern California right now, and smokers are definitely in the minority. And it was just, you know, everybody was lighting up a cigarette every time, there was a scene change. And especially for somebody who's a boxer, who's running, and he finishes running and then he lights up a cigarette. It's like, really?
Yeah, that's, that was how it was. And you can always tell a movie is, I would say, pre, I don't know, 1990 or maybe even 1985 when doctors are smoking too.
Right.
Which, well, I had to write that down. I love that.
I have in my lifetime, I had moved, so I had changed doctors. And so I went to get a checkup with a doctor, and the entire time he was working on me, he had a cigarette smoldering in an ashtray. But that would have probably been circa 1977, 78. So it was very odd.
Yeah. I mean, that's just how it was back then. Smoking in hospitals,
apparently, and
on planes.
Apparently priests drink a lot too. So,
yeah. Well, I suppose if you were going through the stuff he was, you might drink a bit too.
So I was interested though in the progression from her just messing around with a Ouija board and Captain Howdy, and then, you know, slowly but surely it getting worse and worse. And at first you could, you know, fool yourself into thinking, oh, she's just a troubled kid, you know, needs some psychiatric
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting progression. The one thing I thought though was, you know, when they got to the end, I didn't realize that an exorcism was so much work. Anyway, how many times do you have to yell at the demon the power of Christ compels you before?
I think that scene, that section of that scene gets longer every time I watch the movie. I feel like they add another one in every time I see it. Because you're right, it just keeps going and going and going. It's no wonder Father Marin died. He just was tired. He was tired. He was like, "All right, I'm done."
Old guy had a heart attack. So,
by the way, they refrigerated that set that they shot all that stuff in. It was.
Like, I was wondering that when you could see their breath, I was saying, mm-hmm. "Well, there's no way that, you know, there was no CGI back then, so they had to actually have been in a very, very cold room."
Yep. Oh yeah.
In order, either that or they were smoking a lot.
Well, that too, but no, they had the room at like 40 degrees, I think, or something like that. It was one of the things. So William Friedkin was kind of known, especially at this time, for being a bit, I'll be kind and say, loose on his sets. Borderline dangerous in some ways. If you remember the car chase at the end of The French Connection, he shot all that without permits and without staging. They just drove down the street really fast.
Yeah, that seems dangerous.
Yeah, it was. And a lot of those near collisions were not stunt cars. They were just cars on the road.
Yeah. Some poor guy driving to work and all of a sudden you got a car with cameras all over it. Yeah.
But he did some of that here too. So he and Jason Miller got into a bit of a kerfuffle, on set because Friedkin wanted to get a specific reaction out of him, and actually fired a handgun into the ceiling, like right next to his ear or something, nearly causing him to lose hearing. Ellen Burstyn was actually injured. So there's the shot where, Chris gets like thrown back. And she lands and you see Ellen Burstyn kind of grab at her back and scream right before the big chest of drawers comes at her. Yeah, that was she was hooked up to a harness.
Right.
And they had people on the rope and they pull her. They pulled her. She had been telling them, don't pull too hard. And Friedkin basically told the stunt guys, go ahead and yank as hard as you can. And so she fell and like seriously injured herself from that. So he was kind of go a little too far, stuff that wouldn't fly today on a movie set. Let's put it that way. You know, now what it did was it got good performances. So it's kind of one of those things. It's like, I understand what he was going for, but at the same time, you got to find a better way to do it there, bud. But you know,
well, speaking of things that wouldn't fly today, the film director that got drunk, was Blake something?
Burke.
Burke something. Earlier, the girl had, I think it was the same character, has suggested that she and Ellen Birkin's character get married.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the same character.
Yes.
But I mean, the way he treated the butler or the handyman, whatever he was, it was terrible. And, you know, and Ellen Burstyn's, you know, Chris, you know, yells at the butler, you know, to get out. And I think she just wanted to get away from, but then, you know, they're sending him out the front door and wasn't that, you know, that's just,
No,
you can't do that kind of stuff.
No, and I think my note was actually like, "Yep, drunk dipshits at parties—a tale as old as time." But he went like, I forget that too. Like I forget about. I remember him making some comments, but then when he keeps going with it, and he's in the kitchen with him, And all of that. And it's like, oh man, no, you just can't do that. And you certainly don't laugh it off after the fact at all.
Well, and then apparently he got thrown out of the window. And I don't really understand the physics of that, because it looked to me like that window was at least 15 or 20 feet away from the top of the stairs. You'd have to really pitch somebody to get him to go down those steps. But
yeah,
my first thought was, you know, drunk uncle in the room alone in the house with a 12-year-old girl. You know, maybe he deserved what he got.
Maybe. Yeah, actually, it's funny. So the house they shot at in Georgetown for the exteriors and the steps does exist. You can go there. And you're right. In reality, that window is like 40 feet from the steps. And so there's just no way you're going to fall that. But they did.
Or jump, because.
Right.
Because that's.
They did try to build. I think an extra, they put a bit of a set extension they built off to get it a little bit closer, but yeah, there's some little hand waving. It's fine. He made it supernatural. She's
right.
The demon possessed her. She's super strong and can throw him out. But then, you know, then you get Father Karras at the end who jumps out.
Well, and that, you know, he had supernatural strength himself at that point. So
yeah.
Well, and if you just ask a demon to take you over, he goes for it.
Yeah, I think it's that is definitely the hand wavy bit at the end there.
Yeah,
I mean, of all of them, is that he's able to do that. But you know, at that point, I kind of let it go. Like,
yeah,
I've suspended my disbelief enough. I can give it one more step.
Well, and it was early 70s. I don't think we had quite as high expectations for entertainment.
Well, we also didn't have possession movies. This kind of started the possession movies. And now, you know, you get, there's a lot of them out there. And there's probably my favorite outside of The Exorcist is one called The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And it was directed by Scott Derrickson. I want to say it's 2006. It's got Tom Wilkinson in it. It's similar in premise, where you've got a young girl who is possessed, but they're not sure if it's real or if she's having medical issues. The difference is it's half possession movie, half courtroom drama, because the father in this, Tom Wilkinson's character, is on trial based on a wrongful death suit involving the girl. Mm-hmm. But it's a really interesting take on it. And obviously The Exorcist crawled, so that movie could walk. But yeah, this really started the kind of possession movies in general, I think. I mean, there had been, I'm sure, something along the lines, but like true on, full on, like, here's a possession and we're going to try and exorcise. Because exorcisms weren't widely known at the time, from what I understand. Like, it wasn't so, like, today you can talk to just about anybody, and most people, because of this movie and the subsequent sequels and remakes and spinoffs and parodies and all of that, people know what an exorcism is, but I don't think it was nearly as commonly known at the time that this came out. In fact, I did read that the studio wanted to change the title because they didn't think anyone would know what an exorcist was or understand what it meant.
Well, and another thing that I noticed that I thought was interesting was that Father Karras's first name was Damien.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that name had the associations that it did at the time. Well, Rosemary's Baby came out in 1968. And I believe the baby's name was Damien, if I remember correctly. I've never seen the movie, not into horror, but
I know Damien was in The Omen, which I think was a couple years after this. The Omen was 76. So that might be where a lot of the association with Damien maybe came from. But yeah, it is funny that he's Damien Karras. Or Dimmy. That's my, I love that, that diminutive form, when his uncle.
Well, I kept getting Joey Tribbiani vibes from him, but.
That's pretty good. I like that. Linda Blair, by the way, who did get an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. Ellen Burstyn got for.
12.
Yeah. Ellen Burstyn, Jason Miller, and Linda Blair did. Now, there was controversy around Linda Blair's nomination because after she was nominated, it came out that actress Mercedes McCambridge did the vocal work as the demon.
Mm-hmm.
And there were also some stunt actors that did a few things. The spider walk I mentioned was one, but some of the stuff on the bed and some of the things that were going on were stunt person made up to look like Linda Blair. But because of the rules of the Academy, they couldn't take her nomination away. So she was nominated. She kept the nomination anyway. But the combination of all of those made for an incredible performance. I mean, Linda Blair at 12 years old is really good throughout the whole thing.
Yes. Yes. Well, and when she comes down to the party and pees on the rug, they kind of left a Chekhov's gun on the mantelpiece there because she told the astronaut he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess it happened over a fairly short period of time. But, you know, if he'd burned up on launch or reentry or something like that, it might have, you know, it was just, yeah, as I say, Chekhov's gun.
I didn't wonder, because the book takes place over the course of months instead of kind of the few weeks that the movie does. So I'm trying to remember if that that might happen in the book. I'm not sure. In terms of like the astronaut, that, by the way, my note there was, you have all these drunks at the party and it's the little girl that comes downstairs and pees on the rug. Like,
right.
It's a party. Somebody was peeing on that rug, but not who you thought.
Yeah.
But she is combination of, innocent little girl and does a really good job of the slow changes and the minor changes. And I kind of mentioned earlier, but like there's moments where they modulated her voice a little bit. So it's not someone else's voice, it's hers. And they like deepened it slightly and maybe she deepened it a little bit. The way like how she is to start the movie. And then by the time we get to the doctor's offices, how different she's acting. Like, it was just a really good performance out of her at a time when you didn't get as many great performances out of really young actors. It's tougher. It's tough. It's a lot easier now, I feel like, to get a good performance out of kids.
Yeah.
But she was just really, really good. And, I think deserving of the praise that she got for sure. Everybody was in this.
Well, I'm pretty sure, you know, when they were injecting the dye for the CT scan or whatever that scary machine was supposed to be. Welcome to early 70s medical technology. But right. I'm pretty sure they weren't actually injecting a needle into her jugular vein. Mm-hmm. But the expressions on her face were very much as if, you know, she was being subjected to that. So,
oh, and here's an interesting little tidbit about that particular scene. So it's the arteriogram is what they called that. And there's the assistant to the doctor, the guy with the beard that's the assistant. He was an X-ray tech at NYU Medical. Which is where they shot that. So they shot it at NYU. Okay. And he worked there, got in as a small part just to be, you know, assistant there. In 1979, he was convicted of the murder of a film critic and was sentenced to 20 years in prison. While in prison, he bragged about and was the subject in the murder of six other guys that he picked up in gay bars and then would murder them and dismember them. He talked about this in prison. And that was later turned into a movie, also directed by William Friedkin, called Cruisin' with Al Pacino. Was based on the story of that guy. And here he is in The Exorcist. And like 6 years later, he's convicted and sent to jail for murder.
Well, there were rumors of an exorcist curse, but...
there were.
I mean... But Von Cito lived until not that long ago, and he was in his 90s when he died. Mm-hmm. So,
Friedkin just died in October of last year. He was 87.
So, yeah, I suspect it's just that in any semi-large group of people, you're going to find some wackos.
Oh, sure. And, you know, a movie like The Exorcist, you play up stuff like that because it's good marketing.
Yeah.
But I just found that really interesting that an actual convicted murderer is in the movie. And but, you know, as just well,
he wasn't yet, but
he became one.
Yeah.
Oh, and I forgot to mention this. So William Peter Blatty wrote the book and he wrote the screenplay. He was not known as a horror author or anything prior to The Exorcist. He was a comedy writer. He wrote A Shot in the Dark in 1964. Hmm. That was his screenplay. Like, that was the kind of stuff he did. Was
is that Peter Sellers?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an Inspector Clouseau movie, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he did this.
I saw that one in the theaters when it first came out. So I said I didn't see too many movies, but apparently I did. But yeah, I've always gotten a kick out of Inspector Clouseau.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, and Peter Sellers is great.
Yeah.
Peter Sellers was a treasure. But it was funny because William Peter Blatty said that The Exorcist ruined his comedy writing career. Basically ended that. He was just known as the guy that wrote The Exorcist after this movie. And he did go on to actually write and direct The Exorcist 3. He wrote a novel called Legion, and then that got made into a movie, and he directed it and wrote the screenplay. And that brought back Lieutenant Kinderman, only Lee J. Cobb couldn't reprise the role because he had passed away, so it was George C. Scott that played him. Mm. And it's got Jason Miller back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that's why I stopped the movie and brought up IMDb, because my first thought was, is that George C. Scott? And then, oh no, Lee J. Cobb. Okay. It's about the same time. So
yeah. And then George C. Scott actually went on to play juror number 3 in the television remake of 12 Angry Men, who was the juror that Lee Cobb played in the original movie. Which that TV movie was directed by William Friedkin. So it all comes back together.
Well, I have seen the first 12 Angry Men, which I didn't see it when it first came out, but I did watch it, you know, on one of the streaming services not that long ago. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I just recently, I think within the last year, saw that for the first time. And boy, that was a movie that exceeded the hype that I had heard about it. And all I had heard was how it's one of the best movies ever made and all of this. And I watched it and I was like, you people undersold it. I couldn't believe how good that movie was.
Well, earlier we were talking about how it took a long time to develop this. And you mentioned David Lynch. And the thing is, I love Twin Peaks and the movie or movies that went with it. It took a while to develop, but I was just thinking, I think the music had something to do with it. There wasn't that much music in this. The tubular bells just showed up every now and then, but it was mostly, there wasn't a whole lot of musical background.
And that feels very much the product of its time, right? That's that 70s kind of new wave cinema that was going on. Of everything at that point had kind of stripped down, and you were getting stuff that wasn't shot on lavish sound stages and inside the studios. Right. They were going out in the streets and filming. It's French Connection, right? French Connection is out on the streets of New York. Right. And you were also getting a lot less production. So, and music was the big one. And I feel like there's a lot of movies from this era that would do that. You would have these long stretches with no music and it's just the diegetic sound, which, I mean, they did an amazing job with the sound work in this.
Oh yeah. And the Foley work was really good.
Yeah. So. And the,
but then, so it was No Country for Old Men, kind of a callback to that era then, because
I feel like it. Yeah. Which is funny because it was literally 2/3 of the way through that movie before I realized I haven't heard a single note of music. And I
watched
the
entire scene. I watched the entire movie without realizing there wasn't any movie music in it. And it was months later that somebody mentioned in a podcast that, there was no music in the movie. And I'm going, oh, maybe that's why it had such a weird mood to it. So,
mm-hmm. It's yeah, really interesting how music will do that.
This is not the No Country for Old Men episode, but that one got to me, because people that you thought, you know, they had it all together and they were going to get mm-hmm. away with everything, they didn't. So
nope. Yep. No. When you learn that that was a Cormac McCarthy novel,
yeah,
it's like, okay, now it makes sense. Now I get it. So a couple of the famous things in this movie are the head spinning.
Yeah.
Where her head goes 360.
So which was why was she still alive when the demon left her? Because that would have done a lot of damage.
Right. And that was a dummy they rigged up. What's great is the behind the scenes photos of seeing Linda Blair sitting in her chair all made mm-hmm. up next to that dummy with her face. It's just like, oh man, that's gotta be so bizarre to have that. And then the projectile vomiting that she does of the pea soup. It was thick pea soup that they used. And that first time it happens when she nails Father Karras, mm-hmm. that was a mistake. It was supposed to hit him in the chest. Instead, it fired out a little more than they thought. Because I think what they had was like a big hose kind of tube.
Right.
And they would push a plunger. And they must have just done it a little too much and hit him in the face. And they're like, that's what we're going to use. So that, again, real reaction to getting hit in the face with pea soup.
Yeah, well, I heard, I think it was probably on the Film Sack episode, that the Campbell split pea soup wasn't thick enough. So they used Anderson split pea soup, and the Film Sack people didn't know what that was. I live in Southern California. I've been through Solvang many, many times. I know what Anderson split pea soup is. You start seeing billboards with ads for Anderson's about 150 miles before you get to Solvang if you're going up the 101. So, all right.
Excellent. So, and I found this one really interesting. I think I've mentioned this. I want to say I maybe mentioned this on the Gore episode when we talked about this, but Stanley Kubrick was somebody that the studio wanted to make this movie. And he ended up obviously not doing it, but he was impressed by it. I think that would have been it would have been a very different movie in a lot of ways. But part of me kind of wants to see his version too.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he has a particular way of doing things.
He does. And it does make you wonder how much of what he might have done with The Exorcist ended up in The Shining. Because again, he's that same era of long takes and long moments that just sit. So he kind of would have fit this, but it's interesting. Interesting to think about.
Well, this director used a few kind of Hitchcockian tropes too. Like you'd see, now I want to give credit where credit's due here. I heard this on the Film Sack episode about this movie, but he uses, you'll see people talking through a window and the camera just pushes in through the window. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it at the time. The technique looked familiar to me, but that's a very Hitchcockian thing to do.
Yeah. He even had like a straight up Hitchcockian shot when the psychiatrist who puts Reagan under hypnosis, mm-hmm. when he falls back, that's the Arbogast shot from Psycho. If you've ever seen Psycho, when Arbogast falls down the stairs, it's a very similar type of shot to that.
Is that where they're dollying the camera back while zooming in at the same time?
No, that's the push pull. That's like what they used in Jaws.
Yeah.
This is where they lock the camera. Nowadays you would do it with a, like a harness. But basically mm-hmm. you lock the camera dead on to the person. And then as they fall back, the camera's moving with them. So that shot of the psychiatrist, when she reaches over and, as I said in my notes, gives him the Denver jockstrap, and then he falls backwards out of his chair. That's a very Hitchcock shot, because it just follows him all the way to the floor. So
I must have blanked that one out of my mind.
I do really like that scene though, where she goes, she gets put under the hypnosis, just because again, I bought it. Like, I bought that she was under, which for a 12-year-old to pull that off convincingly, it's pretty impressive.
Well, and that not only was she put under, she was possessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the psychiatrist is just humoring her by, saying to the demon that, you know, you're under hypnosis too. Mm-hmm. The demon's not going for it. So yeah, I thought that was pretty good acting. There's, it was kind of like at the end of the movie, All of Me, which is a really stupid movie, but Lily Tomlin and Steve Martin, mm-hmm. I realized that it never occurred to me at once during that movie that Lily Tomlin had not taken over half of Steve Martin's body. You know, you know, so, you know, maybe I'm really good at suspending disbelief, but yeah, while I was watching this, I completely believed that she was possessed and under hypnosis. So.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the sign. I think it was Jimmy Stewart said the best acting is the best trick about acting. Don't get caught doing it. And when you can really dive into these roles and really make you believe that the person is who they are portraying and not just a character, then it works. And everybody did that. Like, I really bought just kind of Ellen Burstyn's, she can't figure it out. She doesn't know what's going on. Chris has no idea what's happening. And she wants to know. She wants to help her daughter, but she doesn't know what's going on. And the people that should know don't know. And it's just frustrating her even more.
Well, and yeah, and she does frustrate it really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
and it's not just angry acting. It's you know, I'd be right there with her in I have a daughter, 35, disabled. And we didn't get a decent diagnosis until she was in her early 30s.
Mm.
So, so she's been, without going into too many details, she's been getting some treatments, which, she was having a lot of problems with chronic fatigue, and she still does, but she's doing a heck of a lot better now. So
that's good.
Yeah. But it was really frustrating there from the time she was about 14 until she was about 32, 33. We didn't know what the heck was going on.
I can't imagine going through that. So,
yeah.
I also read that Jack Nicholson was up for the part of Father Karras. They're again, very different.
Yeah.
And I love Jack. I don't know He works for Father Karras.
No. I'm just trying to imagine. It's just like Jack imagine. Nicholson can't help but being snide. It's
right. Yes.
You know, you can't handle the truth I mean, that's what you love about him. But mm-hmm. yeah, I just don't see him as Father Karras. I don't see him as a boxer, even back then. So
no, I'm just trying to envision. Yeah, I'm trying to envision his eyebrows as he's delivering some of these lines, and it just doesn't work. He looks too sinister, I think would be another word for it. Like, it's hard for me to picture him going through the kind of the emotional arc that Jason Miller does, who he's a broken man. Especially those scenes where he's giving mass.
Yeah.
We see him. He's just broken. He's down.
And it's hard. It's hard to be up on the, I would imagine, to, you know, be up at the altar and being, you know, the representative of God on earth when you're in the midst of a crisis of faith.
Yeah.
I mean, my crisis came when I was 13 years old and I just ran with it. So been an agnostic ever since. But, you know, but I mean, this guy's a true believer, and it's got to be tough.
And speaking of being agnostic, I think that also helped this movie in that it doesn't, it's agnostic towards the church in its, in the way that it deals with everything. It doesn't paint the church in kind of either light, whether super great or super sinister. It's very down the middle of like, they're there, they're doing what they can. Like Father Karras is like, I want to help. I don't know how, but I want to help.
And well, then Chris wasn't religious. She wasn't Catholic. Right. But I mean, she was at the end of her rope, so nothing else had worked, and things just kept getting worse. So
yeah,
why not?
Sure. And as she tells Father Karras, nothing you can do is going to make this worse. So why not? Let's just do it. But I appreciated that part of it. Like there's no ulterior motives. You don't get anything with the church. Like, oh, we're not, you know, you, the church is reluctant to do an exorcism because it's just not something that is done. But when they talk to, when they finally talk to Father Karras, and I like too, it's like, do you think this is going to make any difference? I don't know, but nothing else has been. And then they're like, well, I mean, Father Marin's around.
It made me wonder, you know, when Father Karras took in, you know, a flask of tap water and splashed it on the little girl. What's her name? Anyway.
Reagan.
Reagan. Splashed it on Reagan. And was the demon just screwing with him? And he says, oh, it burns, it burns. Because he was seeing that as evidence that she wasn't possessed.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he was just using tap water.
Yeah, and I think that, again, is a little bit of the carryover from the book of the is she, isn't she? That's a little more, like, by that point in the movie, we're pretty convinced, yeah, she is possessed. We've seen enough kind of physical evidence of that. But I think in the book, because everything's a lot more subtle.
Right.
And they let that carry over. So, you know, it works a bit.
I may have to add that book to my Kindle wish list at some point.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. And it's based on supposedly an actual event that dealt with a young boy and possession, which it's murky how much of it really happened versus how much of it is kind of embellished. But supposedly there was an actual exorcism of some kind of a young boy. And that was what influenced William Blatty to write that novel.
Well, wasn't the Amityville Horror also supposed to be based on
a real incident? that was based on accounts of a real incident with Ed and Lorraine Warren and the Lutz family and all of that. That one has been talked about quite a bit, and it's always, you sort of, with those kinds of stories, I think the more you believe in the supernatural, the more you believe the based on true events part of the story. And if you don't, then you dismiss whatever the actual story is. And I feel like there, I don't know, it's somewhere in the middle. Like, I think some weird stuff happened, but we're never going to know enough to say definitively, but supposedly this is based on something that really happened that then Blatty took and fictionalized and made into this story, which I think fed into some of that hysteria at the time. Plus, let's face it, no one had seen a movie like this in 1973. And then you get...
No, I was just looking. Amityville Horror came out in 77. You think this might have paved the way for it?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
And then later on, Poltergeist?
Mm-hmm.
Which...
Definitely.
Which I saw when it first came out. There was some superhero movie, one of the Superman movies, I think, we wanted to see, but it was sold out for the next four shows, and Poltergeist was the next, and I went in knowing nothing about it, and I was very sorry. The scene in the mirror where the guy's tearing his face off, just, I almost walked out at that point, but anyway.
That movie.
I keep going off onto other movies.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. What do you think, had you gone to see this in 1973, how do you think you would have reacted? Would you have been one of the people that really, that it affected a lot? Or do you think it would have just been something where you're like, I just don't like this?
Well, My apostasy from the Presbyterian Church was very fresh in my mind, and I was feeling very, very much betrayed in those years.
Okay.
That adults that I had trusted had been telling me things that they knew for certain that they couldn't possibly know. This is the way I was seeing it. Mm-hmm. And so I might have gotten, an exorcism is obviously going to be done by a Catholic priest, but as you say, people didn't really know what exorcisms were back then. So mm-hmm. putting my mind back, I was very angry at, organized religion. Still am, actually. There's a lot of things going on in the world that if it weren't for various organized religions, people still find a reason to kill each other, but at least they wouldn't be killing each other because their version of the book is slightly different than but I digress. I have a feeling as soon as I started seeing Catholic priests, I would have started getting very, very angry.
That's fair. I can understand that, especially at that time. I think also, so this movie is constantly touted as, the scariest movie ever made and all this. And then I hear from people who see it for the first time, especially younger people, where they'll watch it and they're like, that wasn't scary. It didn't scare me at all. Why is it called the scariest movie? Why was there all this hype? Why were people supposedly passing out in theaters and all that? But you have to put yourself back in that mindset of 1973, right? And people haven't seen anything like this. Movies, we don't have the 50 years of movies that have come out since this movie that have built upon it. And also, there was a larger Catholic population. And a lot of those stories that you hear were from mm-hmm. cities, right? New York, Chicago. You're going to have a lot more of a Catholic population in those major cities, especially then, than you do now. And a lot more people that are more religious. So that, I think, is a big part of it. Because I certainly know people that I have met in my life, even today, that if they saw this movie, it would affect them. Just by the way that they were raised, by the way that they view things. It never had that effect on me, but...
I don't, even if I'd seen it back then, I have no idea. I mean, that's a long time ago. 50 years. But, the scariest movie, I was trying to think of that while you're talking. I think the scariest movie I ever saw was the first Alien, which I saw in the theater. And, just the chest bursters and suspense of, it was unfortunate because I took a young lady, it was our first date, and she glommed onto me at the beginning of the movie and did not let go of me until the end of the movie. And then she never spoke to me again. Not a good first date movie.
For the 2 hours, the date went, okay.
I was, that's the kind of thing that scares me. Mm-hmm. And saw a documentary one time, The Butterfly and the Octopus, something like that. It was about a guy who had been in a car accident and he was in a coma and he was still conscious, to an extent, but he couldn't move how he was trying to, and that's what scares me, is being, completely conscious in a body that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so,
no thanks.
Yeah.
I did capture a little bit of audio from this movie. If you want to hear a couple of things, just, there's not a lot of like quips, it's not a clippy movie, but there's some moments that I thought were really, really kind of neat. Early on, we spend a lot of time with Reagan and Chris and learning, getting to know them and their kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a good relationship, which I do like. They get along well. They don't fight, that kind of stuff. Even though...
Who that has a beautiful horse is riding through a park and just lets some strange girl ride his horse around?
Right.
Anyway, but yeah, go ahead.
But I liked little things like... this one here, which is this is when she finds the Ouija board and she says,
wait a minute, you need two.
No, you don't. I do it all the time.
And there, right there, is your first indication that things are going wrong for Reagan, because she, I do this all the time. And so that's the movie's kind of shorthand way of being like, yeah, she's in trouble.
Well, and that's the first time you get a little bit of telekinesis too, because Chris takes the thing from her and it just shoots back to her hand.
Yeah. I mentioned, let's see. When Ellen wakes up, or not Ellen. Ellen Burstyn wakes up in the middle of the night to the phone call. And then she turns over and there's Reagan in the bed. And she's like,
what are you doing here?
My bed was shaking. I can't get to sleep.
And like, we haven't seen that yet. But now again, well, was it really shaking? What is she dealing with? But then later on we see, oh no, that bed was shaking. So, yeah, I liked this one just because this is just a great line. This is a total mom line.
Of course I like them. I like pizzas too, but I'm not going to marry one.
I like pizzas too, but I'm not going to marry one.
Well, it turns out the guy was an Adam Henry. I'm not sure what your policy on cursing is.
He wasn't great.
yeah.
We'll say that.
Yes.
Okay. So here is the, I mentioned this earlier, but the subtle things as they started to show the possession physically. The first kind of anything really showing that off is she's in the doctor's office. The doctor's doing the little tuning fork type thing where he knocks that and says, can you feel any vibration? And they have this exchange.
Can you feel this?
I don't feel anything.
And how her voice is just slightly lower and more terse. I like that. That's that subtle stuff that like is starting you down the path where you're not even, it doesn't register necessarily at first that her voice is really any different.
She's a lot more hostile than she has been up until that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course they go with the ADHD type diagnosis or ADD or hyperactivity at the time. And so they give her Ritalin because that was what you gave her. That's what you gave kids back then. And Chris, not knowing what's going on, she's going to listen to the doctor. And so when Reagan says something to her, she just says,
you just take your pills and you'll be fine. Really?
You kind of can't fault her for that. Like she doesn't know what's going on. That's the best advice she's gotten so far.
Yep. Well, and especially in the 70s, if you're wearing a white coat, you have a lot of authority. Mm-hmm. And people didn't ask a whole lot of questions back then.
Nope. You just listen to the guy in the white coat smoking. He knows what he's talking about. He knows health. He smokes
4 out
two
of
packs
five
a day.
Doctors who smoke. Four or five doctors who smoke prefer Camels. I'm old enough to remember that ad.
Oh, man. It's amazing to me that that was an advertisement. But, yeah.
I had an office mate that smoked Camels at one point. That was not good. Anyway, go ahead.
No, when I had that bad habit, it was Camels. It was. But I broke that habit, and I've been good. So I did. So when the doctor, when there's that scene where they have all the doctors and they're all sitting around the table, and the one starts to talk about exorcism and the possession. And I just liked Chris's reaction to that of,
you're telling me that I should take my daughter to a witch doctor.
She immediately went to witch doctor. And I like that. It was just a good line.
And I will tell you, 24-year-old me would have liked that too. Catholic priest as a witch doctor.
Yep. Now, we mentioned Tubular Bells. It's like the song from this. And I just caught a little bit of it because... it's just good. It's right up there. Like that had to have influenced John Carpenter when he started messing around for the score to Halloween, right? Tubular Bells had to have been some influence on him there because it's such a simple little melody, but it's very haunting and ominous.
No, I had that album. I had that album and it was one side was one whole song, the other side was one whole song. So if I was going to be reading or something like that, where I didn't want to be distracted, I'd put it on.
That's perfect. A couple around, based around Father Karras. I did like the guy in the subway who just, and funny thing is his IMDb page, this actor, he is in one movie and it is this, and his IMDb photo is from this scene. And it was just the guy that says,
"Father, could you help an old altar boy? I'm a Catholic."
I'm a Catholic.
And actually, I think later on in the movie, that's reprised. Oh, the voice.
Yeah.
Reagan, I think, uses the voice. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, I liked that. Again, we talked about how Kinderman would sort of dance around stuff with people. And when he first meets Father Karras, you know, he tells him he looks like a boxer and he mentions a boxer. He mentions an actor who was a boxer, and then you get this coming back to him.
Do people tell you you look like Paul Newman?
Always.
Do people tell you look like Paul Newman? And again, it's that dancing around, like how he would mention a movie. He would ask somebody, you know, ask one of them to go to a movie, and then he would just give the most like out there movie, Othello, with Groucho Marx as Othello. And I loved how they would always say, "No, nah, I've seen
I actually it. Would have. I would have liked to have seen that.
I would have. I'd watch that." Again, this is where you've got. So Father Karras comes into things partway through, in terms of like the story with Reagan. Right, Reagan's been going through all this stuff, and I loved this when he's talking to Chris.
"Now, if you've seen as many psychotics as I have, you'd realize that's the same thing as saying you're Napoleon Bonaparte."
I mean, for him, that makes perfect. That's completely logical. Like, he's seen enough people. And then not only that, but having his mother, who's clearly got dementia of some sort as well.
Right.
On top of like her injury, because she had the injured leg, but she's also like things are slipping for her, and he's dealing with that.
Right.
As well.
Well, and so. Chris's first interaction, well, not really an interaction with him, but she hears him talking to another priest.
Oh, right.
She's walking by, and she hears him saying he thinks he's losing his fate. But yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Faith is the word I'm looking for.
So here is, this is the amazing Mercedes McCambridge. It's the only line of hers that I got, but doing that voice, which definitely powered by Marlboro. You know that.
"What an excellent day for an exorcism."
Like, little math question. How many cigarettes would you have to smoke to get a voice that sounds like that?
Yeah. You have to be pounding down whiskey sours at the same time.
Yeah. But man, it's a perfect voice, because it is just chilling. The voice.
My great aunt Joyce had a voice very similar to that. And she was a heavy smoker and drinker. So nicest person on the planet. But
yeah, just the sound, that sound. Yep. And to hear that voice coming out of, you know, Linda Blair in the movie, it's such a great mixture, and it works so well to just put you on ease. And finally, this was the last clip I got, and this is Father Marin. And I just like this line, and I don't know how I forgot about it, but it's Chris offers him some, I think, bourbon, for whatever he's got in his flask or he's drinking. And just his response is great.
"Well, the doctors say I shouldn't, but thank God my will is weak."
"My will is weak." If anything, this movie suffered from not enough Max von Sydow. For as important as his role is, he just isn't in it enough.
Well, I'd pretty much watch Max von Sydow reading the phone book, if you can find a phone book these days, reading the dictionary. But he's one of my favorite actors. His understated comedy in Strange Brew is just perfect. One of my all-time favorite movies, Strange Brew. So
He is fantastic. He's fantastic in this. He does so much in the opening of this movie without saying anything. There's so much.
I was a little concerned when he went walking out of that dig. There was a guy right next to him whacking away at the wall with a pick, and I was afraid he was going to lose an arm. But,
it's true.
And it was long about that time I was thinking, this guy looks familiar. Who is that? I said, I'll look it up after the end of the movie, and I finally realized who he was.
Who's that old guy that looks vaguely like Max von Sydow?
Yeah.
There's so much in him, and to act under that makeup too, is always difficult. And he does such a great job of just showing all of that emotion in those opening scenes. And then, so the version you saw probably then did not have, there's another moment that got cut that Blatty really wanted to put back in. And it's Marin and Karis having a discussion about why the demon possessed a child.
Yeah, that wasn't in there.
Okay. If you can find that, watch that, because it's a great exchange between the two of them, because it's Father Marin basically kind of doubling down a little bit. There's the moment where they're going in and he's like, look, demon's going to lie. It's going to tell you all sorts of lies. Don't listen to it. That kind of stuff. But then they get talking about Father Karis is like, why? Why would it go after, a little girl? And Marin kind of explaining to him, like, it's because she's innocent and to tear us down, to bring us down kind of thing. It's a really good exchange. And I think that was the thing to add into the movie that gave it a little more emotional weight, because we get that, just that moment between the two of them that I think got cut for pacing more than anything, but should have left that in and maybe trimmed some. Also, Max von Sydow playing Father Marin. Later on, there was an Exorcist prequel that came out in the early 2000s where Father Marin was played by Stellan Skarsgård. So it was nice to see another great actor from, I believe they're both Swedish, right? And of two generations playing that same character. It's pretty incredible. The movie's not great, but Stellan Skarsgård is always good. He's another one of those I'll just watch in anything.
I was just on the whole, my will is weak thing. There was a, I think it was Catholic religious philosopher who liked to drink and gamble and have sex. And he had a prayer that Lord give me strength, but not just yet. But I was trying to quickly look it up, but I can't find it. So.
That's a pretty good one, though. That sounds a little Father Marin-ish. I will say, even if you're not a horror fan, I do feel like this is a pretty good movie overall to watch. I think. Do you think had they maybe trimmed and gotten going a little quicker, that you might have enjoyed it a bit more?
Well, I mean, all the clips that you see, I've been seeing almost my whole life. Those are all, once the possession is well underway and she's spitting out pea soup and and all of that stuff, and so I was expecting a lot more of that, and it's nice to have the backstory, but it just seems to me they could have trimmed a little bit out.
Yeah. And again, I completely understand that. I think part of it too, is you've got, 50 years of talking about this movie, and that is what gets talked about. Everything that gets talked about with this movie is the possession part at the end.
Right.
And that's a quarter of the movie. So now there was a recent sequel-ish reimagining called The Exorcist Believer, which wasn't that great. I mean, it was well produced, but it missed the emotional part of things. I feel like it just, part of what makes this movie work for me is that building of the relationship as she's getting possessed. I do think you could trim some of that a little bit and get there a little bit quicker, but what happens is a lot of times movies, especially like Exorcist Believer, spent almost too little time establishing who the characters were before we get to that point. I think if you take this movie, you trim about a half an hour out. So that last half hour is the possession, that last third. Mm-hmm. Well, now we've gotten there 20 minutes faster and you can kind of get to that, I think, a little bit more, but we still spent enough time learning who Reagan and her mom were and how they got along. Like, you could cut out maybe one round of doctor visits because there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, leave it in when she's in the big conference room at the big table and she gets so frustrated, mm-hmm. but,
oh, sure.
Refers, you know, to the priest as a witch doctor. But yeah, it just could have, I just think it could have been better paced, but again, it was a different time. It was that was back. That's the way things, as I said, I've pulled up old episodes of Rockford Files and I've actually commented to my wife in the middle of them. Whoa, pacing's a lot slower in these things than they were. It was like, this could have been a half hour show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like they had a half hour worth of script and they needed to pad it out to an hour. So
like, we paid for the car, we're going to show the car.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, Gary, I'm so glad you came on to talk about this movie. This was a lot of fun. It was nice when you reached out and you're like, hey, I've never seen The Exorcist. You know, my radar immediately goes off and it's like, well, let's fix that. And I'm glad that you got to see it, even if it wasn't quite your cup of tea, like, mm. You can check that off the list now. You can tell people, I've seen The Exorcist. Is I?
Yeah. Yeah. Now I need to figure out how to see Oppenheimer. So,
yeah. That was on HBO services.
Well, it was on HBO for about 10 minutes. I think it's on Peacock at the moment, but currently I don't have Peacock. Retired on a fixed income. And so we're limiting the number of streaming services that we,
I mean, that's fair.
At any one time, so
yeah, there's so many of them now too that it's hard to keep up. But it'll hit one. And you'll get to watch that because it's worth it.
Yeah, I recently subscribed to Paramount Plus so I can catch up with all the Star Trek stuff that I have missed. I'm pretty much caught up with Star Wars because still have Disney Plus. But anyhow,
excellent.
So, thanks for having me on. And if anybody wants to, I have a little Substack newsletter. It's called Diary of a Senior Geek. And people ask me what it's about. And I just say, it's my diary. It's whatever the hell I feel like talking about that particular week. And I have actually found that quite often I will sit down to write one column and wind up writing something else entirely. The other thing I was doing is I had a podcast that started off, the name was Adventures in Social Anxiety, and I changed its name to Diary of a Senior Geek about 4 or 5 years ago. And it was very early in my recording journey. Mm-hmm. And so I've been taking some of the old episodes and recutting them, re-editing them, cleaning up the audio and adding a music bed. So, and those are all stories from my life.
Very nice.
And I'm going to skip all the ones complaining how Trump was not handling COVID. I'm still on the stories of my life right now. So anybody interested in that, just seniorgeek@substack.com.
Excellent. Seniorgeek.substack.com. Check that out. I subscribe to the free newsletter. So I get those. And it's great. I like that. And thank you so much for being here. This was super fun. We'll do this again sometime. We'll find another one maybe you haven't seen, or, you know, maybe there's something you love that I haven't seen. Who knows?
There are a bunch of classic movies out there that I have not yet seen. So I'm sure we can find something. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Travis.
Thank you. And if you enjoy this show, you can check it out. I record live on Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern time at twitch.tv/TVsTravis. And you can also check it out as a podcast. Anywhere you get your podcast, comes out on Wednesdays. This is the 260th episode. I've been doing this show now for 5 years. When I started, I didn't think I would get to 1 year. And now I'm at year 5 and going strong. So thank you to everybody who listens. I appreciate it all. If you want to check out other things that I do, you can go to tvstravis.com. And there's links for merchandise with my logo on it. There's also a Patreon if you want to join that. And there's links to all the shows that I do. And you can find them all at tvstravis.com. Until next week, in about a week and a half, because I will be out of town next week. But Jason from the Esoterica Cinema podcast is coming back. And we're going to talk about a movie that I haven't seen, and yet I've wanted to. And it's called Upgrade. And I can't wait, because this came out in 2018, and it looked really interesting to me. It came out really close to when Venom came out, and it's kind of a similar idea. Some guy gets it's a sci-fi kind of horror in a way, or sort of action sci-fi. You get some kind of augmentations. I've heard nothing but good things about it. I remember the trailer and just never got around to seeing it. So Jason Peters from the Esoterica Cinema is going to come back, and he's going to make me watch it. So that is the next episode, which we'll be recording on a Wednesday. So keep an eye on the social medias and on the website, and I will make sure you know when that is happening as well. But Gary, thank you so much for being here. This has been just a blast. We're definitely going to do this again sometime.
You're very welcome. And maybe I'll send you a list of movies I haven't seen, and we'll figure it out.
That sounds great. And until next time, just remember to enjoy your movies, regardless of what they are. And let's be excellent to each other.
I beg your pardon?
Never seen it before in my life. Have you?
That was Burke. I mean, what an asshole.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.